I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Sensational! The Kickoff with Cathal Minogue and Sky Sports.
Watch every Premier League match this season with Sky Sports and Sports Extra.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Kickoff. I'm delighted to say I've got my man Kevin Kilbane back for another... I didn't scare you away the last time, Kevin. You're back for another
No, I'm back for more punishment. I think that's how it is, yeah?
Yeah. How are you? How are things in Canada this week?
Everything's good. We had a good week, actually, after I spoke to you last week, but we've had about 2 foot of snow that has come down overnight. So, and literally... it's dropped to about minus 15. It's amazing the way that the weather... it's been minus 15 overnight last night. So
really?
We've had, as the old say, we've had a cold snap coming through, you know?
Yeah. You're built for that, though. You have to be.
You get used to it. I tell you, you get used to it.
I'd imagine they're more prepared for it over there. I mean, when a cold snap happens here in Ireland, it can just cause chaos.
Yeah, I always remember, probably we're going back 7 or 8 years at this stage now, when I was in Dublin. Do you remember when we had that, it was like a hurricane type storm that blew in and all the airports closed down? It's probably going back to 2018 at this stage now, 2017 maybe.
Yes.
Airports closed down. Dublin closed down for about 3 days. Nothing opened. The ports getting out of Dublin. The boats couldn't leave. The airplanes couldn't leave. And I always remember that. Now, in comparison to here, we'll get it way colder. We'll get way worse weather. But the ploughs are out almost immediately. Usually they are anyway, unless it's severe. Last night we had a bad one last night. Yeah, so the once the ploughs get out, the roads will be done and everything will get back to normal within a few hours. To be honest with you, yeah,
we just can't hack it here. That and rain. Even though like we're expecting the rain, but it can still cause absolute chaos. I treated myself yesterday. I said, you know, it's a free world, and I finished up work around 3:30 yesterday, and I said, I have nothing on this evening now. I'm going to check the cinema times. And I strolled on down to the IFI there in Temple Bar. And it was myself and there was a couple of other guys on their own as well, actually. And we all sat down to watch Saipan.
You know what you probably need? You need to grab yourself a beer or something and just go in on your own and just sit down. Can you imagine the amount of men that have done that? They're walking by and go, I'll go and have a look at this.
Yeah.
The amount of men, it's probably the most male-dominated movie ever in Ireland, isn't it? I would imagine that'll be the way it would be. I can't imagine too many couples going to watch that movie.
Yeah.
But what did you think? What did you think anyway?
Yeah. Well, obviously, I had the thoughts in my head that you were saying, you know, that didn't happen and that didn't happen. And to be honest with you, even if I hadn't chatted with you, I found it all a bit of a parody at times.
Yeah.
And then, but also Aina Hardwick's performance as Roy Keane. Obviously, I don't know Roy Keane. I've never met the man. Obviously, you know him a lot better than I do. But I thought his performance was just so incredible. And then there was all this kind of pantomime going on with the other characters. I felt like it just didn't match. That's probably just a movie thing. But I mean, it just seemed very ridiculous. I'll also say, I thought out of all the characters, what a drive-by on Niall Quinn's character.
He
cannot be happy with that.
Quinny really had a bottle of beer out of his hand. We're in team meetings. I think there's one scene where they're in the medical room and I think one of the lads is maybe getting a massage or getting some form of treatment and Quinny's got a bottle of beer in his hand.
Yeah, Roy is getting the hip looked at by the physio and he's with the bottle of beer in his hand and wearing a Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah. Oh, man. Honest to God, it was. There was so much within it. There was so much when I like I said to you last week, almost every scene, well, that didn't happen. And I think I took it for what it was, pretty much is what you're saying there, the parody. It was quite funny. It was quite funny watching how we were portrayed as a group alongside Roy as this, beacon, this angel that was around the team that was almost a separate entity, which at times Roy probably was a little bit like that, but it definitely wasn't as it was portrayed with the team. And I when I'd said to you last week about so many. I mean, there must be six or eight of our team that wouldn't touch a drop of drink. And there's probably three quarters of the team that if they had a drink, it would have been one or two beers, particularly when they're in the squad. The drinking culture, I think, within football had changed so much. Everyone talks about Arsene Wenger, but it was essentially Arsene Wenger when he came into English football around the mid-1990s. It changed the whole concept of the game, certainly from what we were used to. So everything after that, you might get a night out if you get in early to get in with the team. You may get a couple of beers here and there. I'm talking like 4 or 5 days before a game. But once you were getting ready for the games and when you were getting ready for training, like I rarely across my whole career went out the night before training and was drinking, knowing full well what was in store the following day. So I think that they maybe got the generation wrong on it. That's the only thing I would say. It was maybe the Euro 88, Italian 90, USA 94 squads that may have got away with those antics. Whereas so many of our boys were totally different from that. It was a wrong interpretation of the team in general. That's all I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. One question. I don't want to. It's not really a spoiler, but obviously everyone knows that there was an infamous bust up between Mick and Roy. Were you actually having karaoke on the stage before the meeting? Like, is that true?
There was some slight truth in that. Well, famously, and I think the story's been told, Carl, in the past itself. The next door, we were having dinner. The room was very much a lot tighter than that. The room itself, it was like a big ballroom that Mick walked into for that meeting. It wasn't like that. It was almost like probably a tenth of the size. There was three tables in a very small room where we were eating. And next door to us, there was, I don't know how to describe it, Spanish guitarist, Hawaiian music. I don't even know how to describe the genre of music, to be honest with you. But there was a guy playing guitar and there was dancers and things like this. And Gary Kelly went and pulled the guy into the room before our meeting starts. We'd all finished dinner. So your man was playing the guitar and one or two of the lads were dancing on the table. So it wasn't necessarily a karaoke. It wasn't us boys playing karaoke, but right. There's an element of truth in that. There was an Hawaiian guitarist, a Spanish guitarist or whatever it would be. So you can imagine there was a lot of commotion in the room when Mick McCarthy actually did come in. Yes.
Okay. That's interesting because I was thinking, well, like that either something like that did happen or it's just total far-fetched. So all right, so there's a bit of truth.
No.
In that. That's interesting. I was wondering.
Yeah.
Ina Hardwick, as I said, I thought his performance was brilliant. It's hard to see past Steve Coogan.
I agree with that. I do. I think he did well. I think he did great. It was a great portrayal. It was, and I think he did manage to. I did think he found what Roy's essence essentially. I think that's because there was a lot that was in the portrayal of Roy and how he was like and what he was like. So there was a lot within that, and it was a very good performance from him. I have to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. And for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's definitely worth watching. It's 91 minutes actually. So I mean, it's the length of a football game, and it plods along nicely. And at the end of the day, you did get to the last 16 of the World Cup, like, you know, and I'm probably
in the movie twice. The first time I'm missing a penalty against Spain, and the second time I'm in tears hugging Mick Byrne, who was our physio.
Yeah.
They're my only two appearances in it. So they've killed me full stop on it anyway.
Well, I would say you should be glad, because the way they're portraying some of the actual players in the movie with the actors, I think you got away lightly. You don't know what they could have done with you. Honestly, God, poor Niall Quinn. Anyway, so yeah, we recommend going seeing it. Anyway, that's
I think it's worth a watch. It is worth a watch for what it is.
Let's talk a bit of Premier League news. The last time we were talking, Ruben Amorim was sacked as Manchester United manager, and the talk was either it was going to be Ole Gunnar Solskjaer or Michael Carrick will be in as the interim manager. It is Michael Carrick, that's confirmed. Steve Holland is with him, Jonathan Woodgate, Johnny Evans, and actually, speaking of Roy, I seen him a clip of him today questioning what has Johnny Evans done to say that he's good enough to be part of this backroom team as a Manchester United coach.
Yeah.
What experience does he have? I don't know. It's kind of a bit like, there's a lot of Manchester United fans in around Marconi, as you know. There's obviously Dave Moore, who I work very closely with, is a staunch Manchester United fan. And he actually doesn't even have the energy to chat about it. He's a bit like, whatever. It kind of has that feeling, doesn't it?
I know. When you talk to United fans, you know that wherever you go across the world, you'll always meet Man United fans. So you know that there's always going to be that big topic of conversation. And I think after Ferguson left, what, we're going back 12-13 years or so now at this stage, aren't we? After Ferguson left, there was that real clamour around the next part, what's it going to be? And the next 3 or 4 years, there was real anger from United fans about how it can go so wrong and the turnover of managers, Moyes, Mourinho, Van Gaal, whoever it was going to be. It seems now when you talk to a lot of United fans, it is a bit sad that it feels as though that they're losing a little bit of the passion a little bit. Do you not feel that? I don't know. It's a little bit, you know. Definitely. Whenever I spoke to Liverpool fans over the years, Liverpool fans, even when it was going wrong for them and they weren't winning leagues and things like this, maybe they were still in the hunt and they were still winning trophies. It has to be said, that Liverpool. But even though they get so, you know, so animated about the club, they were still always defensive about the club. And you know, I've had many an argument with a Liverpool fan over the years, but you always felt as though that no matter what, no matter if, even if it was the worst thing that one of the players did or one of the managers did or the club was doing, you always felt as though they were still on board with what was happening. They were still on board with the club. It doesn't feel that way with United, does it? It's almost as if that, whatever. That's the way I think with United fans now. It does feel a little bit like that. And then in relation to that, I said it last week, it just seemed a little bit strange that they're appointing an interim in Darren Fletcher with the actual knowledge that they were actually going to appoint a second interim going in till the end of the season until they can get something in place. It just seemed a bit crazy to me to have that sort of mindset. Give it Fletcher, let him take it for 5-10 games and find a permanent successor going forward. And if that took to the end of the season, it takes to the end of the season. This scenario that they've got going on right now, what's going to happen if United lose the next 3 or 4 games and they want Carrick out? They're going to be then pushing now to get another manager to get in quickly. It might not necessarily be the correct appointment to get him in there quick enough. And before you know it, it'll just be going around in this vicious circle that they've been on for the last 12 years where the wrong appointment's going to be made. I just don't get the whole the United thing at the moment. I really don't. It's just it just seems crazy the decisions that's being made at every level. So in relation to Evans, the only way I would say with Johnny Evans, I would say Roy, I've not actually seen Roy's comments, to be honest with you, Cole, what he's made about it. But I think that having Johnny Evans, who was still playing very recently, having a little bit of a link within that coaching staff, that might make a little bit more sense and why they've done that. But I mean, the whole United thing at the moment, you can't even call it frustration now. It just seems a little sad, doesn't it? When you're watching this great Roman Empire almost that's just falling down, and it seems like it at the moment it's never going to be rebuilt.
Yeah, and it must be just so frustrating for Manchester United fans when a lot of it is at board level. And the thing is, like, getting knocked out by Brighton in the FA Cup during the week as well.
Yeah.
They only have the Premier League to focus on now. I think it's something like they have 17 games left in this season.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, they still have a great chance. They're seventh in the league at the moment. They still have a great chance of getting qualification for Europe. Now, I will say their next two games aren't too nice. This weekend, they play Man City at home. Yeah. Kickoff is at 12:30 and it's live on Sky Sports. And then they have the treat of heading off to play Arsenal. So, it's not a great start for Carrick, you know, whatever happens.
No, it's not. It's not. I know that, you know, at that level, you have to play the teams and that's the way that it is. But you would want a bit of a kind of start when you're going in there, wouldn't you? And the pressure's on them. I think I read something, Carl. You'll probably know it yourself. It was something, this is the least amount of games United are going to play across a season in, I think it's 30 years or something. It's something stupid like that, something ridiculous.
It's since the First World War.
Is that what it is? Yeah, there you go. There you go. It's crazy to think that United are out of all cup competitions at such an early stage. No European football. That it's been the staple of Man United now for the last 30 years. As long as I've been watching them since I was a kid, United were always, you know, whether it would be Cup Winners' Cup triumph in the 90s, early 90s, and Champions League that they had through the 90s and the success and the big nights that they had at Old Trafford through the noughties as well. It's been amazing the way that it has fallen. And United now, to me, Carl, it just seems that if you, I've never really watched a lot of North American sports and got fully on board with how a franchise system works. A franchise in North America, whether it's NFL, whether it's NBA, whether it's hockey, or whatever your sport is over here, it's irrelevant whether you're successful or not. It doesn't really matter. If you look at Dallas Cowboys, I think they've been valued as the most expensive club in the world, most expensive franchise sports organization whatever in the world. The success that Dallas Cowboys have had over the last 20, 30 years, it's been irrelevant to the success of the team. That's what United are now. They're just like a franchise. They're just like a team that makes money. The team is almost in place just to make money for the owners. And the success on the pitch is secondary to how the club is being ran. And that's what they are now. United essentially are a franchise. Is that what football, as we know it now, as a kid growing up, is that what football has become in any way? I don't know. It doesn't seem that way with a lot of teams that's around. But if you look across Europe and if you look how the game's been run in Germany and look how it's been run in Italy and places like that, maybe I'm being wrong, but certainly Germany stands out to me as it's about the fans. It's about the organisation, the 51-49. It'll always be in favour. The percentage of the club will always be owned by supporters in general.
Yeah.
That's not the way in the Premier League. So it is a franchise now. That's where we are. And it is quite sad that the success now that's always been there for a lot of supporters and this huge club that's being built, it does seem like it's fairly irrelevant to the success of the organisation now.
In terms of Arsenal, Kev, they're looking really, really strong, aren't they? They had a brilliant win against Chelsea in the League Cup semi-final as well during the week. They won 3-2 away. It was in Stamford Bridge. They're looking really strong, although you would say January was kind to Manchester City. Semenyo looks like he was a great buy, also scored during the week, and it's just been a great start to his Manchester City career. But it does look like this is Arsenal's to lose. And I've been hearing a few United fans in here saying, oh wait, this is what they do. They will panic at the end of the season. It's very hard to see now. It looks like they're in prime position. They're sitting pretty at the top of the league. You know, Manchester City could sneak up on them.
Yeah, you could. You have to say that you could. City have steadily built across the year. They keep having this odd game along the way, don't they, where they throw in a bad performance and a heavy or a bad loss. So they maybe have that in them. Going back 3 or 4 years, it was the World Cup year, actually, the in 22-23 season, when Arsenal were so dominant in the first half of the season and you felt this is going to be their season. And the World Cup that was obviously put to the winter that year seemed to affect them, because when they came back into the new year, they seemed to struggle and they couldn't find the consistent form that they'd shown prior to that World Cup. So it's very different now, of course, but that might be something that a lot of people can throw as a negative thing to them, that they've been in this position before and they weren't able to hold on to it. They've been top of the league on numerous occasions over the last few years and they've not been able to sustain it and get the title at the end of it. But it does seem that with what they're doing, they're so hard to score against. They're so hard to play against. Whenever you watch them, you rarely see them conceding goals. I know they conceded two against Chelsea in the Cup this week, but they are so solid in the structure of the side. And I think that's something that Mikel Arteta has purposely done, tried to make them very solid and very resolute defensively and difficult to play against. And the quality essentially that they've got within their attacking areas and midfield areas will take over. And they've not been scoring a lot of goals. They've not been great to watch this season, but they're a little bit of a throwback to the Arsenal teams when I was a kid, watching them under George Graham, when they were able just to grind out results and just go week in, week out. And, you know, the old adage of Arsenal winning 1-0, they're a bit better than that. They've got a bit more quality than that. But they're finding ways to win games at times. Set pieces has been the stronghold of them this season. Not being great to watch. They're just so hard to play against. So is that how they're going to win the league? It seems unlikely. If you thought about it at the start of the season with how teams have won the league over the last 10 years, because it has been about scoring goals as well as winning games, you know, continuously, or dominating opposition, dominating possession and things like this. Arsenal are not, although if you watch them a lot, they do dominate possession in games, but they're not really free-flowing in the final third the way that I've seen them across the course of this season. So they're solid, they're a bit of a throwback to maybe an age of or a time 20 years ago with how maybe titles were won a little bit in that fashion. So it might be just a little bit of that, Carly. It might be that, and that they maybe learnt about how they've played in recent years, where they've been a bit too open in games.
Yeah.
They've tried to go and beat teams 2 or 3, and they think, well, maybe we're better off just being a bit more solid and being a bit pragmatic in how we're going to win it this year.
We were speaking about managers there and managers in and out, and Alonso obviously got the sack from Madrid. Could you see a case where Liverpool, is Arne Slot now kind of sitting in his chair a bit more, a bit uneasy and thinking, oh God, you know, if his job was in jeopardy, would Liverpool be thinking, no, Alonso mightn't be a bad fit. The club absolutely love him. The fans love him. Could there be a case maybe if Liverpool's form doesn't improve drastically that there could be a case where Slot goes and Alonso could be a man to come in?
Well, he would be the natural lead candidate, wouldn't he? I think we know that with his obviously links to Liverpool as well. He was heavily linked last season, wasn't he? When Slot actually originally came in, but he decided to stay another year at Leverkusen anyway before taking that Real Madrid job. I think there's been a lot of talk this year about Slot being under pressure and things like this, and I don't think I think only in recent months, I think there's been more made around what has actually happened across the summer at Liverpool and the effect that is going to have on the players. You've played sport in a team environment. I have. You know when something happens to a teammate or when something happens to family members of teammates or something affects a teammate, it affects the dressing room. You everybody knows that have played team sports knows that is the way. There is no way that incident with Diego Jota this season could not affect the team. It was never going to be a case of the team just showing up and being, you know, ready to go again and defend a title. So I don't think, even at the time, I don't think there was a lot given to the team and the respect that you need to give to that team for actually just going out and being able to perform again, regardless of the results, just going out and stepping over the line with so much scrutiny that's on you when you're playing at top level football anyway. So I think that was always going to have an effect on them. So I think the club it looks to me, again, as an outsider looking in, I know that we've heard stories of Slot being under serious pressure, but I do feel that the club have decided, look, we have to give it a season. We have to really respect the manager for what he's had to deal with and what the players have had to deal with. So if Alonso is going to be going into Liverpool, I would imagine if that is a scenario that does happen down the line, I don't think it's going to be before the end of the season. I do feel as though that Slot, with everything that's happened and the fact that he won the title last season, does deserve to be given at least a year in the job to see where he's going to go. But just in answer to that question, I can see if there is a change, and there is going to be a change across the course of the year, 6 months or whatever it's going to be, I could see Alonso stepping in there and doing a good job. Yes, I do.
Yeah, and that's a fair point too. They play Burnley on Saturday. I meant to ask you as well, United versus City, as we said, it's a rotten first game for Michael Carrick, rotten first two games. But it's in Old Trafford, 12:30 Saturday afternoon. Do United stand any bit of a chance? What do you think?
They've been okay recently against City, haven't they? The only way that you can see them doing it, I'm even going back to a couple of years ago when they won the FA Cup final against City, when it was almost play with no striker, pack the midfield, just try and maybe stifle the game a little bit and stop Man City. That's the only way that I can see them winning the game. I can't see them going out. And it's how I've seen that Manchester derby being played out in the last few years anyway. Man United are almost trying to stop City not necessarily going out to play a game, being open and trying to win it almost. It's almost if we'll play to draw the game, anything else will be a bonus if we can score from a set piece or maybe a counter or something like that. I think that's how they're going to approach this match. And City are just so dangerous. You mentioned Semenya started so well. The players that they've got within City, whether, you know, the 20, 30 players that they've got, we know how dangerous it can be. And Look, I'm not saying you asking me the question. I don't think City will lose that game. Yeah. That's the way that I see it. I think City will, at the very least, take a draw from that game. Mm. But I think the way that it's gone over the last 10 years, not necessarily in recent times, the last 10 years in that match, I think City, it's heavily favoured for them. They've got way too much quality. They've got way better players. Everything's going for them right now as well. They're in great form. So I think City will win that game, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I had a great chat this week, a special episode that is out in the podcast feeds now for anyone that has missed it. I had a great chat with George Hamilton this week about the art of match commentating. And obviously there's just some iconic lines. Actually, do you know what? Let's treat ourselves. Let's relive one of them.
David O'Leary is entrusted with the responsibility of taking the penalty that could send Ireland into the quarterfinals of the World Cup. This kick can decide it all. The nation holds its breath. Yes, we're there!
That moment brings you straight to Italia 90, that iconic commentary. Mm. And there have been some fantastic bits of commentary, you know, throughout the years in every sport, but obviously focusing on football. You did a good bit of co-commentating, didn't you?
I did quite a bit, actually. Yeah, I was working at Virgin over in Ireland and I used to do loads on Off the Ball as well, radio commentary.
Yeah.
I used to enjoy doing radio commentary because you could have a bit of crack when you're doing the radio commentary, usually with Nathan Murphy or Dave McIntyre. Back in the day with those guys as well, even on TV as well, doing the Virgin stuff that I used to do. But yeah, I've done quite a lot, actually. I used to work for the Premier League as well. So I used to do a lot of their games that used to go on the world feed that would go to the countries that wouldn't necessarily have their own broadcast and they just had the rights to the game. So I used to do stuff like that, but I used to enjoy it. I really used to enjoy it. And what I used to always find with commentators, they've got the most amazing minds, commentators, and you know, you'll see, you know, George himself. I spoke to George many a times. It was great to meet George when I first got into the squad. I remember meeting him, probably going back to late 90s at this stage.
Okay.
And this iconic voice and this person that you met, you know, and I met him actually at World Cups as well when I was working at World Cups doing the commentary myself. Yeah. But some commentators used to write things down and they'd have a line ready. And some used to improvise, be on the spot and things like this. So it was so funny seeing the commentators and how they used to do things, writing the stats down for all the players and reeling off one or two stats from a game and then getting this line, waiting for somebody to score and reeling off a line. So it's an art in itself. You know, even watching the Gaelic football over the years and the hurling and seeing the great commentators that we have in Ireland as well that would do those games. I don't know, there's something special about a great commentator that enhances the game for you, isn't there?
Yeah, totally. And I was saying that to George. I was saying we've been spoilt over here in Ireland with all the iconic GA, rugby and football commentators. And I'd say it's a tricky business being a co-commentator. You know, like there might be, I don't know, maybe you can tell me, is there more work in that than there would be in punditry? Because maybe not more work, but is it a bit easier review a game, I guess, you know, because you have time to look at the game, you have time to think about what your analysis is going to be. Whereas co-commentating, you're there, you're in the moment, you're getting one look at this and then you're getting the replay on the screen. So it's a bit quicker, like you don't get much time to confirm your thoughts or have a real think about it.
Yeah, I think it is. I think I more work in that. I used to try to do as much as I can for every commentary game that I was doing in terms of looking at every individual, watch the team a couple of times in the previous games that they would have played as well, getting a good feel for them. Certainly when we're ahead of the World Cup now as well, the World Cup we got coming up, trying to get to. I'm not doing any commentary probably this World Cup. It looks unlikely anyway. But if I was, and when I've done World Cups in the past, and say I was doing a South Korea game or an Iran game, players that we wouldn't be familiar with at all, trying to get at least five games in of those teams, watching them, making sure that I've got a feeling for how they play, the system that they play, tactics or whatever, set pieces, how good are they on set pieces, who takes set pieces, what sort of runs are being made in the central areas when the set pieces are being taken. So I would always try to get a top of all that sort of thing, certainly when I was doing the commentary. So I would have always tried to put a lot of work into it when I would have been doing them. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and there is a lot of work in it, and that's what I was asking George as well, because he's meticulous with pronunciations of names, and that's something very tricky as well. And we kind of had that iconic Italian 90 moment not so long ago when Troy Parrott got the third goal against Hungary in Budapest, and you had Darren Maloney and Ray Houghton just absolutely lose it. And that's brilliant too, because that's what we want, because we're all losing it watching it.
Queenie Kelleher, Scales is up after it. Scales wins the header. There's a chance. Yeah! Oh, there's the goal. That's Troy Parrott. That is unbelievable. He scored a hat-trick. And right at the death, Ireland have done it. I've never seen anything like it. Absolutely remarkable. Right at the end, Hungary had been caught. They were hanging on, it seems like, for the whole night. Certainly when it went 2-2. This is just stunning. 3-2. The time is up. The referee has to finish the game. I've no voice left.
I know. That was a thing. I don't know how many times you watch that now at this stage. And the more you watch it, actually, the better it gets. You know, sometimes when you watch things, it loses its feeling sometimes when you watch something so much. I must have watched that 1,000 times. I actually watched it again this morning. It popped up into my feed on Instagram and watched it again. Yeah. Dara, do you know what? If you ever watched the whole highlight package that goes out, Darren Maloney after the penalty goes in was great. You know, now it's like game on, guys. Yeah. And then when Troy Parrott equalizes for the second time, when we make it 2-2, when he does the little chip, we have 10 minutes. Come on, or something he says. Like, if, and you kind of get right into it. I remember watching the game myself, and I was feeling that Dara got me going. He really did, listening to it. And then at the end, when Dara's trying to get his words out, and you can hear Ray in behind screaming, it was great commentary, amazing commentary. And, you know, watching, Dara's a great commentator listening to him. He's done GAA over the years. I used to always remember him doing the, more so the Gaelic football, actually.
Yeah.
And I used to love listening to him, but I never really heard him doing football, doing soccer over the years. And he started to do a lot more now, and he has that voice, doesn't he? You know, we have some great commentators. You mentioned George Hamilton there. Dave McIntyre's a great commentator.
Brilliant,
it would be great to listen to. I would have worked with Conor McNamara, another one, whether that would be at the BBC or he does Premier League stuff around the world. And Dara's another one. They're great to listen to, and they enhance us. I don't know. It's the Irish accent as well, the Irish voice, I think, that does get you. It's just it's amazing to listen to these guys and the passion that they have when they're doing the job. It's great to listen to. Yeah,
yeah. It makes you feel like you're there and you're a part of it, and that's the magic of it. And their use of words as well, like a nation holds its breath. Like, to even think of that, to have the talk.
I don't know how they get it out. I don't know how they get these words out at times and how they can articulate the magnitude of certain situations that they're commentating on. Sometimes I remember I've done some huge games. I remember being in Lille, actually, watching Ireland against Italy at Euro 2016 when Robbie Brady scored the goal from Wes Hoolahan's pass. And I pretty much did what Ray Houghton did. I was commentating the game and I just screamed. I couldn't even get any words out. I don't even know what I said in the aftermath of the game. I was probably waffling absolute crap. I just don't even know what I was saying. So when a commentator is able to articulate his words and you know, makes sense actually in those big moments, that is a huge skill in itself. And it's great when you can hear the very best commentators able to put everything into context. And I always remember, I was listening to that Hungary game as well, and I've listened to it so many times. Dara actually put it into context about the magnitude of that result. We've not qualified for a World Cup yet. We know that. Yeah. But we know where we've been the last 10 years. We know how terrible the performances have been at times. We know we've been, you know, it's not been a great watch, let's be honest. And that's given us all hope again. And to bring that hope back to us all, that's what Dara did. And that's a special skill in itself.
Yeah. And I love when people on the internet as well mix it with the Titanic music. Any bit of iconic commentary is just the best. It's an absolute treat. Brings a tear to my eye.
Have you seen those two boys over in Australia that have done it? Well, I can't remember what they're called now.
Are these the guys that do the miming? The
miming. They've done Dara. This is Dara's voice, and these two guys are miming. The great crack. Really, really funny to watch when they're doing it. So I saw the commentary from the game as well, from the Hungary game, those two doing it. It was brilliant.
That's when you know you've made it, when those lads are doing it. That's one of my favourite bits of iconic commentary is actually in the darts in the 2023 World Cup final, when the two boys are on nine darters, Michael Smith and Michael Van Gerwen, and it's I can't speak. Wayne Mardle. It's just it's fantastic. It's like that's more of that. More of that.
Yeah, yeah. Your man misses the double, doesn't he? Yeah. He misses the double for a nine darter, and the other boy gets up and gets the nine darter,
yeah,
doesn't he?
Yeah, brilliant. He goes, this is the greatest leg of darts ever, ever, ever. It's just so good.
They're both on a nine. This is insane. Come on now.
Wow, the World Championship final. Michael Van Gerwen is on a nine darter in the World Final and just misses double 12. Over to you, Michael Smith.
One man misses, does the other man get? I have never seen the like. Come on, Spolly boy. Yes, double 12.
Kevin, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks a million. I really appreciate it. Now that you've hit the big time with Hollywood, it's great that you still have time to talk to me here, because, you know, it's just like you're in the movies now. You're in the cinema on the big screen, you know?
I'm in the movies on the big screen, probably one of the worst moments of my footballing career. But anyway, there you go.
I can only imagine. Yeah, it's a tough one. It's a tough one for you to watch back. But hey, you're brave enough to take the penalty. That's the main thing. Thanks a million, Kev. Really appreciate it. Hopefully we'll be talking to you again soon. And you never know, during the summer, we might get John if Mayo are doing well. And you know,
Did you say when?
Okay, when Mayo are doing well. We'll definitely get John for a GA chat as well.
Good stuff. Thanks, Carl. Thanks, Kev.
Manchester United have done all they can. That Rooney goal was enough for the 3 points. Manchester City are still alive here. Balotelli, Aguero! I swear you'll never see anything like this ever again. So watch it. Drink it in. Two goals in added time for Manchester City to snatch the title away from Manchester United. Sensational!
The Kickoff with Cathal Minogue and Sky Sports.
Watch every Premier League match this season with Sky Sports and Sports Extra.